The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, today, our guest, Richard Duncan. We've had him on before. He's a fascinating guy. As far as analyzing the problem in the economy, I don't know that we've interviewed a better author as far as the analysis goes.
Well, and frankly, both the problem and the solutions offered are very intriguing because, as he notes in the New Depression, the breakdown of paper money, there's a number of things that have changed over the last 100 years. One, we've moved from a gold currency standard, which we know, to a fiat currency standard. But more subtly, there's been a shift away from just simply fiat money to a massive expansion of credit instruments. And in fact, he argues in the book that we've moved to a situation that is hyperinflationary in terms of our credit expansion. The only thing that masks that hyperinflation is one key component, globalization, and a tremendous drop in labor rates.
And whenever I read Richard Duncan, especially this latest book, The New Depression, I have to admit, it is hard to fight depression because what he's basically saying, it's a little like sitting down with the doctor, and the doctor is a terminal disease doctor, and he's saying, now listen, you've already got the disease, and Richard Duncan would say the cancer that we have is actually this new creditism instead of capitalism. Now what he's saying, and this can be very controversial, we'll just warn the listener right off the bat, that Richard is saying, now that you are going to die, how long do you want to extend that life? And if we take radical procedures that are not what we started with, maybe we can survive this.
Well, very specifically, I mean, if you look at a drug addiction, Kevin, there's hard drugs which are actually difficult to break the addiction to, but possible. If you're addicted to alcohol, on the other hand, trying to break that addiction can kill you. And that's kind of the interesting relationship we have to credit. He looks at the quantity theory of money, which was put forth by the great monetarist at the Chicago School, and he says, actually, we've shifted from the quantity theory of money to the quantity theory of credit.
In other words, how much credit can we take out so that we can grow? No longer does it depend on money like it used to.
It does a great job looking at what happened with quantitative easing 1, quantitative easing 2, specifically the policy responses put in place by the Federal Reserve. He compares and contrasts our future policy options, what was past tense possible with capitalism and sort of the laissez-faire model, and what we've adopted. And I think he's right to point out, we left behind capitalism 100 years ago.
Well, we've talked about that before, David. I mean, 1914 was sort of a critical date for all of us, even though we weren't alive at the time.
Well, and I think this is a healthy thing for all the Occupy Wall Street folks to acknowledge, to recognize, or at least to be taught, and it certainly may not be reminded because I'm not sure they were aware of this particular nuance, that what they are objecting to,
what they're angry about,
quote-unquote capitalism, is not capitalism. It is...
It's cronyism. It's this...
It certainly is. It certainly is. And what they don't know is they're asking for the government to solve the problem, quote unquote, of capitalism.
With more of what they hate.
When in fact, and ironically, they're going to get exactly more of what they already have, which is the state running things and running things on a very corrupt basis. Richard Duncan looks at the difference there in his book, The New Depression, of the outcomes. Hyperinflation, hyperdeflation, and the role that credit plays in the system. And I think this is a very important book. I'd encourage our listeners to look at it and analyze, reappreciate the role of credit in the business cycle. Because without an expansion of credit, you don't have growth in the economy. And that, again, goes back to one of the things that we left behind, credit expansion being vital to the business cycle, what used to be in its place, not credit expansion, but capital accumulation. We see this great transition away from savings and investment towards consumption and borrowing in order to consume. And in fact, we're seeing that same sort of theory of credit being expanded into places like China, where again, capital accumulation is not the future growth model. The future growth model is in fact very similar to what we've had over the last 100 years, for the better or for the worse. Again, credit creation replacing capital accumulation.
Well, David, as we go to that interview, I must say that you often recommend books, and sometimes you say, oh, this is a must read, and they are good books. A lot of them can be quite deep. A lot of them can be quite technical. Richard has a way of writing and telling you ahead of time what he's going to tell you. He tells you, you know, in the introduction, what the chapters are going to do. He gives you great conclusions that are no more than about a paragraph or two long. And actually, if a person were to say, guys, 2012 book, please, that tells me how we got here and where we're probably going, I think this is probably one of the best books to recommend.
On a number of occasions, we've spoken with Richard Duncan, and whether it was a book that he wrote many years ago about the dollar and concerns that he had about the dollar, or his more recent book, The Corruption of Capitalism, which as an office we read. So, you know, 50-odd people in-house read and discussed the content in The Corruption of Capitalism. Now transition to something that he's been working on, the newest project, The New Depression, the title of his latest book, The New Depression, The Breakdown of the Paper Money Economy. And we want to look at some of the themes there because he highlights and contrasts the monetary system that we thought we had with one that actually is far more important. Let's look at that. Looking back at the last 100 years, you'd say that many things have changed in our monetary system. In fact, one of the gradual moves was away from gold, and that was initiated first in the first several decades of the century, with fiat money becoming more and more prevalent. It eventually emerged with a system that was not even recognizable, where money as we think of it, greenbacks, are actually far less important than the expansion of credit, and that'll be one of our primary themes today. More a change in what constitutes money. You know, again, there's along with this change in what constitutes money, a change in the U.S. business model. As you note, this is a radical shift away from savings and investment and towards credit and consumption. Can you give us in a nutshell, Richard, this move towards a credit-oriented money system?
Yes, okay. Well, thank you for having me on the program again. The big change, I think, happened in 1968 when the U.S. changed its laws and no longer required the Federal Reserve to back dollars with any gold whatsoever. At that point, the nature of money changed. Up until then, we had been on a commodity-backed monetary system. In other words, gold backed up our money. Afterwards, we moved to a pure fiat monetary system or pure paper money system. And afterwards, the nature of money changed. Before, if you took a dollar bill to the Treasury Department, at least in theory, they were meant to give you some gold in exchange for that. Now, if you take a dollar bill to the Treasury, they will just give you another dollar bill. So what's the difference between a dollar bill now and a 10-year Treasury bond? They're essentially both credit instruments. In the past, there was a clear difference between money, which was gold, and credit. Now that the difference is blurred, or perhaps there is no longer any difference, money is credit. And so the nature of money changed. That really changed. That was the beginning of the big change in our economic system.
Well, so money is now credit, and simply maybe one of the differences is it's credit that does not pay interest. That's a helpful distinction for us because as we look back, we remember the riots of 1969, and we know Nixon changed the relationship between the dollar and gold to the detriment of our foreign creditors, closing the window in 71. You're suggesting 68 was a critical date, and certainly the French were aware of what was happening, sort of as we were degrading the value of the dollar. And so you're saying that there's actually policy moves that were made that suspended, even before Nixon closed the gold window, that began suspending that relationship.
Yes, of course, when Nixon in 1971 in August ended the Bretton Woods system by refusing any longer to allow other countries to exchange their dollars into U.S. gold. But before that, President Johnson in 1968 had asked Congress to remove the requirement that the Fed maintain its gold backing for dollars. Up until that time, the Fed was required to keep 25% gold backing for each dollar. And Johnson made a speech to Congress, and he said, we don't need to keep gold to tell us what our money is worth. We've moved beyond that. But oh, how wrong he was. Once we broke this link between dollars and gold, everything began to change. And the most important thing that changed is credit absolutely exploded. Total debt or total credit. Debt and credit are really two sides of the same coin. Total debt in the United States, and by that I mean government debt, household sector debt, corporate debt, and financial sector debt, all debt, first went through $1 trillion in 1964. Over the following 43 years, total debt expanded 50 times to 50 trillion. So from 1 trillion to 50 trillion in less than 50 years. This explosion of debt completely created the world we live in. Our world was made out of that credit. We have all been much more prosperous than we would have been had we remained on a gold standard. This ushered in the age of globalization. It allowed Asia to pursue its very successful strategy of export-led growth and transform China from a very third world country into the China we know today. So this explosion of credit completely changed our world. And I would really suggest that it created a different kind of economic system, which I'll discuss a little later, I hope. But the thing is that in 2008, we hit the limit, it seems, for credit to expand any further, at least on the private sector side. Because in 2008, the private sector effectively went bankrupt and couldn't repay its old debt and was cut off from any additional debt. And it was at that point that New Depression, as I call it, began.
The New Depression, we're approaching the period, or arguably we're in it today. You're assuming that credit expansion is the hallmark of growth in a credit-dependent economy, and therefore if credit is contracting, that naturally the economy is getting off the rails. You've just suggested that your private sector credit expansion ended in 2008, but perhaps there's something else that can fill the gap. My one concern would be, and maybe this harkens back to even just the title of your book, The Corruption of Capitalism, how do you avoid public sector debt expansion and having that be legitimate in terms of going towards real needs and growth-oriented projects as opposed to sort of the crony capitalism that we've seen where perhaps the debt expansion, the credit expansion, is just to the friends, quote-unquote, of those in Washington, D.C.?
Yes, well, very good question. In Chapter 9 of the book, the new book, The New Depression, I describe how our system evolved from laissez-faire capitalism into this new system, which I call creditism, for lack of a better word. And I think the starting point for everyone in the United States, what we all really need to understand is that our economic system hasn't been capitalism for decades. Laissez-faire capitalism died in World War I, when Europe went off the gold standard and when all the European nations, the governments took over their economies to fight the war, followed by the U.S. jumping in and taking over the U.S. economy to fight World War I. And then not that long after, the U.S. government took over complete control of the economy again during World War II, controlling all aspects of production, prices, and distribution to fight the war. And effectively, the government's been spending between 20 and 25% of GDP every year since World War II. So we haven't had capitalism for now coming up for a century. And that's the starting point. We don't have capitalism. To move to something else where we're discussing a better way for the government to spend money, this isn't abandoning the economic system we have now. It's adapting the economic system that we have now to make it work better. The economic system we have now is creditism. Let me explain. Capitalism, the growth dynamic under capitalism, it was driven by the private sector. Businessmen would invest, and some of them would make a profit. They would save that profit, or in other words, accumulate capital, hence capitalism, and they would repeat the process, investment, savings, capital accumulation, investment, savings. And that was the growth dynamic. It was very difficult, and it took a lot of hard work. Well, that's not the way our system has worked now for decades. The growth dynamic in our economic system has been driven by credit creation and consumption, and more credit creation and more consumption. And that's worked miracles. That's created very rapid economic growth now for 4 or 5 decades. The problem is this new economic system seems that it's hit the full extent of its potential to create any more growth and actually could quite possibly now collapse into a very protracted depression because the private sector can't bear any more debt. And that means only the government sector can bear any more debt. And so the real issue is, how is the government going to spend the debt that it's going to accumulate to keep the economy from collapsing into a depression?
And before we move to that, because that's a very important point, it was the GSEs, the government-sponsored entities, which played a vital role in credit expansion in this 40 to 50-year period. The household sector witnessed a major balance sheet addition as home values increased, as stock market values increased. There was this extension of cheaper and cheaper credit. It seems that, in fact, those circumstances may not be repeatable. So I want to talk about one thing that is important, I think, to the private sector or individual investor. discuss real estate and home values. Without a $40 to $50 trillion credit expansion, what would fuel the next housing boom? Perhaps you're not so sanguine in this area.
Ideally, we want to avoid creating credit-driven booms because they always bust. Every boom busts. That's the first law of macroeconomic cycle. Second law is the bigger the boom, the bigger the bust. So we don't want to just fuel one boom after another. That really seems to have been what the government's policy has been for the last 15 or 20 years. The stock market boom followed by the property boom. That's unsustainable, and we should avoid that. We need to think of ways to invest this debt so that we can grow the debt and grow the economy, but not just creating boom and bust. Actually, accumulate debt, but use the debt that we accumulate to invest in new industries so that through that investment we can generate a return that will be sufficient to repay the debt. So it needs to be about investing in what I call transformative 21st century technologies on a very aggressive scale so that rather than just wasting this money, we can actually invest it and generate fantastic new technologies and new industries to keep the United States the dominant economic power far into the future.
We're aware that in the private sector, there is a very large multiplier in terms of credit creation, and there's almost, again, a building in or a multiplying, a compounding of that effect in the economy. With government sector credit expansion, is there the exact same kind of multiplier, or is it a different effect, really, in the economy?
Well, I fear that I will sound like a heretic by what I'm going to say, but I think we really need to keep an open mind and look at this rationally and understand that almost every major industry in the United States is already subsidized by the government in one way or the other. Agriculture, the farmers and the corporations that own the agro businesses, they get government subsidies. All the industries that make weapons, they get government subsidies. The pharmaceuticals and the hospital industries, they are subsidized by Medicare and Medicaid. And the universities are subsidized through these processes also. So already all the industries are getting government support. So we need to understand that. And we just need to change the way that the government's supporting the economy, because already the government is driving the economy. Once that is understood, it doesn't seem so radical to suggest that the government should drive the economy in a more rational way.
But the question I would have is, if the growth dynamic from this point forward is related to the credit markets, you're talking about an expansion of government debt, it really does require future monetary intervention in order to keep interest rates at a very low level. Today's number, we can, at 2.18%, finance a tremendous amount of debt, over $15 trillion, and it costs us a mere pittance, $300 billion in interest payments. Of course, tongue-in-cheek, $300 billion is no longer a pittance. But if that rate were 3.5% or 4%, now we're moving into a range where we may have a growth-oriented model based on the expansion of government debt, but can we actually pull that off, so to say? And then I guess this is where I would ask, you know, we've looked at the lost decade here in the United States. How is our lost decade different than that of the Japanese? They've actually been able to keep rates low. So one, how have they done that? How have they accomplished that? And will we be able to accomplish the same thing? And are we looking at sort of a different dynamic in terms of the lost decade, ours versus theirs?
Right. When we first spoke 2 years ago, we discussed at that time the Congressional Budget Office projections in the U.S. for U.S. government debt going forward. And it was already clear that we were going to have trillion-dollar budget deficits for as far as the eye could see. And indeed, this year the budget deficit is going to be $1.3 trillion. It's been roughly that amount in the preceding 3 years as well. So it's really not a question of whether we are going to have these budget deficits. We are definitely going to have these budget deficits. It's just a matter of what the deficits are used for. Now, so it's not a question of whether the money is going to be spent. It clearly will be spent. So the question is, how is it going to be spent? Now, in terms of the interest rates and comparing the U.S. with Japan, well, yes, Japan's bubble popped in 1990, and their interest rate on their government debt is less than 1% for 10-year government bonds. So in Japan, they've been able to take their government debt from 60% of Japan's GDP, now it's up to 240% of Japan's GDP. And they've been able to increase that government debt. And the reason they've increased the debt is because they had to have very large budget deficits to prevent their post-bubble economy from collapsing into a 1930s-style depression. And so they've managed to finance these debts at very low interest rates. They financed the spending, and they've kept Japan from collapsing into a depression. Now, the U.S. is going down the same road. Our big bubble popped in 2008, and interest rates have collapsed ever since. The 10-year bond yield now is, I think I saw, less than 1.9% this morning. So when big bubbles pop, the people who made all the profits during the bubble years, those people realize that they have to do something different with their money than they did before, because if they keep speculating as they did during the bubble era, their profits are going to be destroyed. So they move their bubble profits into government bonds, and that pushes up the price of the bonds and pushes down the yield. And the same with the corporate cash flow. Every year, corporations have a lot of cash flow. If they continue to invest and build new industrial capacity, their money is going to be destroyed because there's already excess capacity across every industry globally, and capacity utilization is low. So they don't want to build more capacity. So they put their annual cash flow into government bonds as well. And that's another reason that bond yields are so low, both in Japan and the United States. But additionally, now in the U.S., Japan has had some paper money creation by the central bank, but not on a huge scale, or at least not on a huge scale by current standards. The Fed has been more aggressive in creating paper money, and now the European Central Bank also, with the most recent LTRO, which created something like a trillion new paper euros. These have been very aggressive moves of paper money creation, much more aggressive even than Japan. But as a result of those moves of paper money creation and buying government bonds, in the case of the Fed, this has driven down interest rates even further. And the reason they've been able to get away with this, one of the main reasons that this hasn't already led to very high rates of inflation, is because of globalization. Globalization is putting extreme downward pressure on wages globally. In fact, it's resulted in a 95% drop in the marginal cost of labor. Before, if you wanted to hire an industrial worker to build an automobile, you had to pay someone in Michigan $200 a day. Now you can pay someone in India $5 a day. And so this collapse in wage rates is creating extreme disinflationary or deflationary pressures that has enabled the central banks to get away with massive paper money creation without creating high rates of inflation. Now, they won't be able to continue doing this forever, running trillion-dollar budget deficits and financing with paper money, but they should be able to do this without too much more difficulty for another 5 years, perhaps even 10 years. The problem is 10 years from now, the U.S. government is going to be just as bankrupt as Greece, and at that point, then very, very bad things will begin to happen. So it's crucial to change the way the government spends money between now and then, and actually have the government spend money in a sensible way through investing that restructures the economy and generates new technologies that restructures the U.S. economy and eliminates the global imbalances that have led to this crisis and actually prevents us from collapsing into a new severe Great Depression 10 years from now.
Once again, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com.
When you look at innovation in the market, you're often reminded of the private sector filling gaps and discovering niches and really, you know, driving innovation. Do you think possible that government can take on that role of innovative thinking when the tradition is more quite the opposite? And I think looking back at history, you would see pet projects chosen rather than dynamic and growth-oriented projects.
Well, I mean, once we all agree that it would be a good idea for the government to change the way it spends money. I mean, for instance, the government has spent $1.4 trillion invading Iraq and Afghanistan. I think it would have been a better idea if the government had spent $1.4 trillion developing solar energy or perhaps developing genetic engineering or biotechnology. But so going forward, they're going to spend this money. And once we agree that it would be better for them to spend in a different way rather than wasting the money on unnecessary consumption.
Sure.
Once we have that understanding, once we agree on that principle, then there are many ways the government could distribute this money. Once it was decided the government should invest or spend on investment purposes, they could actually certainly involve all of the innovative capacity of the private sector. They could distribute the money in a variety of different ways to the most innovative or to the best projects or to the best managers, or they could allow the private sector to do the actual innovation. It would just be the government funding it. And, of course, sharing in the profit of the successful innovation.
That's healthy. Let's assume that we do end up propping up aggregate demand that is deficit spending, and we have an economy that's rolling forward on that basis. We're not moving towards a 12, 13, 15, 20% contraction in gross domestic product. stocks and real estate benefit from expansion of credit. To what degree are these asset classes impacted by a slowing in credit growth, a contraction in the credit markets, at least in those areas? I mean, again, we're not talking about a total contraction in credit, but again, we've seen a benefit directed towards these two asset classes. And I don't know that we can assume that just an expansion in government credit would have that same sort of positive impact for housing and the stock market per se.
Okay. Well, so the Austrian economist, von Mises, for instance, I think they were right in their explanation for how credit creates an artificial boom. Von Mises famously described the process through which credit creates an artificial boom, but the day always comes when credit stops expanding. And at that point, the boom just doesn't flatten out at some permanent level of prosperity. All the good things that happened during the boom, they then go into reverse, and the new depression, or the depression as he calls it, begins. So in terms of what now happens if credit stops expanding, the difference between our world and the world von Mises lived in was he lived at a time when there was a gold standard. And so in his world, credit could only expand, or the money supply, gold, could only expand for a relatively limited short period of time, because there was a limited amount of gold, and you could expand the money and credit based on that money for a short period of time, but then you ran out of new money, and so the credit expansion had to stop, and the boom turned to bust. And so this created relatively mild boom and bust periods, and from his point of view, they should have been avoided completely. Now, the difference between his world and our world is in our world, there was no limit, it seemed, for how long credit could expand. For 4.5 decades, credit went from $1 trillion to $50 trillion, creating an unprecedented global boom. So the danger is now, if this credit actually begins to contract, that we won't just have a temporary mild boom and bust or a bust phase. Our bust could be as protracted as the boom was. In other words, this could be a depression that goes on for decades, just as the Great Depression in the 1930s went on for an entire decade and didn't end until World War II started and government spending increased by 900%, and that put an end to the depression. Of course, that war also put an end to 60 million lives. So, yes, if you're talking about asset prices for houses, if credit begins to contract, then it is going to become a very protracted depression and house prices will fall much further. But now, as to your question, whether expansion of government debt will be sufficient to keep house prices from dropping, well, I think nothing drops forever. And we have to have some equilibrium between asset values and income levels. Ultimately, the median income of a country determines its economic growth. Median income has to go up in order to create sustainable economic growth. And if asset prices become very overly inflated relative to the ability of individuals to finance those inflated asset prices because their income is not high enough, then sooner or later the asset prices have to contract. So there must be a sensible relationship between the income of society and the asset prices in society. There's no way to maintain a disequilibrium there for too long. So asset prices, property prices have already dropped now 34% on average in the U.S. They may drop a little bit further, but we're going to get closer and closer to the point where this equilibrium between income and home prices has been reestablished. So the government spending and the government debt will be, again, we have a $1.3 trillion budget deficit this year. That's roughly 8% of GDP. This isn't going to go away, but this spending is the thing that's keeping the economy from collapsing into a Great Depression, and it's going to persist. It's just a question of how we spend the money.
That raises the issue. It is a budget-related issue. We've had the credit markets, which have begun to contract, signals that that is sort of game over for an era of credit expansion. And then, of course, you've got, in this cast of characters, Ben Bernanke, who's likely to continue his stimulative policies, the zero interest rate policies or various forms of quantitative easing. The problem is, successively, the quantitative easing measures had less and less impact. So that brings us back to your point of, on the fiscal side, how do we spend the money and can we spend it more effectively? Do you expect to see Ben continue with some of his monetary policy measures?
I do, yes. I think one way of looking at this, a useful way of looking at this, is to imagine the global economy as being a big rubber raft. But instead of being inflated with air, this raft is inflated with a lot of credit. And on top of this raft, and floating on top of the global economy, You have all the stocks and all the bonds and all the commodities, including gold, and you've got 7 billion people. Now, the problem is that so much credit has been inflated into this raft, the raft has become defective. It's full of holes, and the credit is leaking out numerous holes all around the side of the raft as the credit gets destroyed. It can't be repaid because people just don't earn enough money to repay the debt. So the raft is defective, and its natural tendency is to sink. And as it sinks, all the stocks and bonds and commodities and gold start to go down together. And for that matter, the 7 billion people start to sink. So the policy response has been and is and will continue to be to pump in more credit every time that happens. Pump in more credit through budget deficit and paper money creation, either by the Fed or by the ECB, or wherever necessary, to reflate the global raft. And when they do pump in more credit, the raft floats up again. So stocks and bonds and commodities and gold, they all go back up again. And that's what we saw when the first round of quantitative easing. That's what we saw with the second round of quantitative easing. And that's what we saw with LTRO. So in order to prevent the raft from sinking, this is what they're going to continue to do again and again and again, because they're absolutely terrified that if they don't do this, the raft will sink and it will be an absolute replay of the 1930s and the 1940s. And in the 1930s, when the credit bubble that began in World War I, when the gold standard broke down and blew up during the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties, when that credit bubble popped in 1930 and that depression started, the government just stepped back and let market forces determine a market-determined equilibrium. And unfortunately, that equilibrium was at a level of GDP that was 46% below what it had been in 1929 in the United States, and at a level of unemployment that ranged between 15% and 25% during the decade, a decade in which Europe turned fascist and Germany took over Europe and Japan turned fascist and took over Asia. And then World War II started with, of course, disastrous consequences for everyone. So the policymakers are absolutely terrified that exactly the same thing is going to recur this time. And for that reason, the only policy response they have is to create new credit to replace the old credit that's being destroyed. And so, yes, there will be QE3.
It seems to some degree that we're just repeating the mistakes of the past. Massive credit expansion led to the situation that we have now, where our options are limited. We're forced into a pragmatic position of we either continue with the same course to a slightly variant degree, and perhaps a degree that's maybe on steroids. But really, we're just talking about, again, an expansion of credit. Politics was less in play during the gold standard era in terms of there being a consequence. As you noted, there was a mild boom and bust cycle, and that mild boom and bust cycle did have an impact. Minor deflations did impact the constituency groups that were sort of in the lowest tier of society economically and socially. So, yes, you had unemployment issues, but again, they were mild boom and bust cycles. Now we are in a boom phase. We've been in a boom phase since the end of the Bretton Woods era, circa 68 to 71, and we need to continue that boom cycle. The question is, was von Mises right? Can you continue to artificially inflate? We're in a position where pragmatically we have to say we must, or the results could be dire. But the question is, if we don't seek a mid-course correction and look at a radically different alternative, as painful as that may be, even if we accepted GDP at a 20% lower level today, what if the market forces the massive contraction in credit, destruction via deleveraging, and it is on an out-of-control basis? As you say, maybe that's 5 to 10 years out, but what does that horror look like as opposed to a more moderated and chosen course today, which is simply, we can't do this. We can't continue on this course of credit expansion forever. We know that. Let's not just kick the can down the road. How would you respond to that?
I would say it's like death. It's better to kick it down the road for 10 years than to have it occur today. And that's the situation our economy is in now. If we allow the credit to begin to contract, then and we spiral into a new Great Depression, then our civilization very well may not survive. And there is nothing that could be any worse than that. So there is no deader than dead. Our economy now spirals into a new Great Depression. This economic crisis will become a severe political crisis globally. It's very likely that we would have a breakdown of globalization. It's very likely that there would be a trade war, and the geopolitical consequences of a trade war would quite easily lead to a real war. And who knows how that would end up. So I propose that we don't try to find out. rather than allowing this collapse into a new Great Depression today, let's try something different. We know that the U.S. government's debt is now roughly 100% of GDP, whereas Japan's government debt, 22 years into their crisis, is 240% of GDP. So I think that the U.S. would have no problem taking its government debt up to at least 150% of GDP, which would carry us quite easily 5 to 7 years into the future. And they may be able to take it up even to 200%. Who knows? Which would take us 10 to 15 years into the future. And I think that is what they will do. Because unlike in the 19th century, when we were on a gold standard, in the 19th century, most people didn't have the right to vote. No women had the right to vote. And a very significant portion at the end of the 19th century of the men didn't have the right to vote. Well, now everyone has a right to vote. And it's democracy. And if we have very high rates of unemployment, these people are going to demand additional government spending. And the politicians are either going to give it to them or they're going to lose their jobs, and the next set of politicians who come in will spend more money. So I'm almost certain that the money is going to be spent. So that gives us the option then. The money is going to be spent, so our only real choice is not between austerity now or austerity later. In other words, the choice is not between collapse now and inevitable collapse later. The choice is between austerity and collapse now, or what we will actually have going forward. It will either be 10 more years of wasteful government spending supporting the economy, and then we collapse. Or the alternative is we spend the money differently and actually don't collapse because we're clever enough to actually invest our way out of this crisis this time and don't have to repeat the mistakes of the 1920s and 1930s and 1940s. So I hope that we could learn from our past mistakes and invest our way out of this crisis. But even if we don't, I'm certainly in favor of postponing the collapse as long as possible, because it will be no worse 10 years from now than it will be today. And in the meantime, we will have enjoyed another 10 years of life and prosperity.
Well, Richard, I agree with you. I think in terms of the spending, I think what I'd love to see, and perhaps you can suggest something to this effect, there needs to be an accountability, a return from the politicians, the pork barrel spending politicians of today, back towards something that looks and feels more like a statesman, because the tendency has been for politicians to line their pockets. You can't go through Congress today and find someone who's not worth several million dollars if they're not worth $10 million or $100 million. And you don't make that kind of money in Congress. You're paid $100,000 to $200,000. And yet, as a lifetime politician, they've figured out ways of making mass fortunes. And it looks like the same kinds of corruption that you have in North Africa or anywhere else where money is spent, but there's not a real constraint or accountability put on it. Essentially, you've got politicians who are using their Rolodexes and political influence for personal gain. What you've set up here is an accurate picture. The stakes are incredibly high. The geopolitical consequences of a trade war turning to a real war, that's been a topic of conversation for us for several years now, looking at a crisis that morphs from a financial to an economic, from an economic to a political, and ultimately escalating to a geopolitical. At least in theory, we can go there. And yet we've got politicians today, and I think in some sense big business leaders, who are basically of the opinion, I'm going to get mine now. I don't see this as working out in the long run, and better my personal gain than the long-term success or viability of this company. And we've seen that in a number of companies in the past, whether that's Enron or WorldCom, or at the national level, where politicians are as fast as they can lining their pocket. How do we prevent that from happening? If, in fact, we need to spend $1 trillion, frankly, I don't want to see a lead cent go in the direction of a politician who's, again, looking after his self-interest rather than the state's interest.
Yes, fair point, indeed. Of course, politics has always been corrupt, and government throughout history, the government officials have lined their pockets. It is part of human nature, I suppose, or at least that's certainly the way it has always been. Throughout the history of the United States, there have been episode after episode of public corruption. Now, we just have to take that as a given, I'm afraid. We don't have time to change human nature during this particular crisis. So we need to get everyone incentivized to move in the right direction. And by everyone, I mean the Occupy Wall Street people, Tea Party people, the lobbyists, the corporations the lobbyists represent, the bankers, and the bureaucrats. all to realize that we need to make this economy grow, or we're all going down together. And so if we make the pie grow, we're all going to be better off. If we let the economy collapse, then we're all going down together. And so we don't have time to sort out human nature and make sure that not a single red cent lines any politician's pocket or any corporation's pocket or any banker's pocket or any poor person who is too lazy to work, as some people would view it. We don't have time to sort that out now. What we have to do is we have to make our economy grow. And so all of these interest groups need to work together to make sure that happens, to make the pie bigger. And over time, we'll then have the leisure to be able to make sure there's less corruption all around and perhaps a more fair system or a more just system from everyone's perspective.
Richard, I know you can't give the perfect asset allocation model, not knowing every listener who's out there wondering, well, what does this mean for me? What actions am I supposed to take? Obviously, we're in desperate circumstances. Some sort of insurance policy is necessary. How do I sit on the fence between the success of this particular project, if government is able to hold this together and create growth? How do I position for that? And if they should fail, how do I position for that? Is there a watertight approach, a balanced approach, if you will, as you look at the next 5 to 10 years, perhaps only the next 2 to 3 months, but, you know, in some sort of a time frame, short term, intermediate term, long term, what are the rules of the road, do you think, for the global investor?
Okay, well, in the short term, I think the rules are pretty clear. Because our global raft natural tendency is to sink, we know what the policy response is going to be. It is going to repeatedly be to pump in more credit through more and more rounds of government spending and more rounds of fiscal paper money creation. And so before long, the raft will begin to sink again, and stock prices will go down, and asset prices will all go down, and the global economy will look very endangered. And about that time, Chairman Bernanke is going to go on CNBC and tell us that there's going to be QE3. And that's the time for everyone to go long risk assets. That's what it's designed to do. That it will make all the risk assets go up. So when Chairman Bernanke goes on TV and announces QE3, everyone should be long risk assets. But he will also tell us that the date that they are going to stop QE3. And when that date arrives, that's the time to take your profits and get out and wait for the raft to sink again, and asset prices will all go down again. And you can wait for a little while for the correction to occur, and then there'll be QE4. So in the short term, it's just risk on, risk off based on paper money creation by the club of central banks led by the Fed and the ECB. So that should be relatively easy. You can bet on bailouts, in other words. Now, in the longer run, it's far more difficult to say exactly what's going to happen. I mean, realistically, while I believe there's good cause to fight for what I'm advocating for, government investment on a very large scale and transformative 21st century industries to resolve our crisis, realistically, that's probably not going to happen. Now, looking out 5 to 10 years, the global economy will still be directed by government policy. What the government policy does will determine the direction of asset prices 5 years from now and 10 years from now. But we don't know who the government is going to be 5 years from now or 10 years from now. So if you had to lock in an investment portfolio that you couldn't touch for the next 10 years, for example, then the course that I think would be one that would be most sensible for most people would be to have a very broadly diversified portfolio that could survive either high rates of inflation or severe deflation. Because if the government spends too much money and prints too much money, we are going to end up with very high rates of inflation. On the other hand, if, for instance, Ron Paul is elected and bans the Fed and implements government austerity, then we're going to collapse in severe deflation. So the truth is, it's very hard to preserve wealth. If it were easy to preserve wealth, the families who were wealthy 200 years ago would still be wealthy today, and normally they're not. And in the kind of environment that we're going to face over the next 10 years, a great deal of wealth is going to be destroyed. Now, if you have to lock in a portfolio today, you want to have a portfolio where you would accept the inevitability of part of it being destroyed, and the compensation for that would be that not all of it would be destroyed. So if you have a broadly diversified portfolio, say with blue chip stocks, preferably with a good dividend yield, and even bonds, government bonds and blue chip corporate bonds, next commodities, mostly gold, and then you could have residential property as the fourth part of your portfolio. For instance, if you have a great deal of money, you could buy residential buildings in a good location that you could let out, people. And the fifth part of the portfolio would be borrow money at fixed interest rates to finance your residential properties. But it must be at fixed interest rates. Now, with that kind of diversified portfolio, part of your wealth would be preserved either any way it goes, either high rates of inflation or high rates of deflation. If we have lots of inflation, it would be bad for your bonds, it would be bad for your stocks, but it would be very good for your gold, and your rental property would still be intact. And the higher rates of inflation would basically make your fixed interest rate debt evaporate. On the other hand, if we have severe deflation, then that would not be good for stocks, but it would be very good for your bonds, and it wouldn't be good for your gold, but you'd still have your rental property. And the rent might adjust down, but price of everything would adjust down, so you'd still be relatively better off. So with that kind of diversified portfolio, you can reserve some of your wealth in the future despite almost any possible scenario. So if we have an extreme deflation, the trick is to make sure that your assets deflate less than your neighbor's assets, so you'll still be richer.
It's very similar to a simple model that we've suggested for many decades, where a part of the mandate that you adopt is liquidity, which is cash and cash alternatives. A part of the mandate, on the other hand, is growth and income, which is stocks and bonds. And a part of the mandate, the third mandate, if you will, is insurance related, commodities, specifically precious metals. And, you know, taking a balanced approach, acknowledging that, A, you don't know exactly how the future will look, and B, you don't want to put all your chips on one number, one color. And this is the circumstance we're in today. It is difficult to preserve wealth, but it's vital to do and make a best effort to take a balanced approach, not knowing exactly what policy measures will be implemented and what the market response will be. Richard, I have to say, yet again, we will be reading this one as an office read, The New Depression, and we go back to the conversations that we've had over the last several years. You know, we've discussed the exit strategy from the current monetary policies. This was some months back. We've discussed the creation of money and credit, and again, the government's rescue tools, whether that's nationalization, money creation, debt acquisition, debt guarantees, forbearance. I mean, I feel like our conversation continues, and you've played a vital role in what we continue to offer for our listeners, our clients, as they seek to understand the times that we live in and take perspicacious action. What should we do? We thank you for your opinions today just on that point, and we look forward to a continuation of the conversation over the years and months ahead. Keep up the good work.
I look forward to continuing this conversation, too. Thank you again.
Well, David, the stakes really are high. You know, listening to Richard, I think of the period of time when someone is shocked and has to adjust to a new norm, like we were talking about, possibly a terminal disease that may or may not end well. They go from denial to anger, and then slowly to acceptance, and then action. Action is so important. And, you know, we have talked now for 5 years about things moving from the financial to the economic to the political to the geopolitical. I mean, we're talking about life and death here. We're not talking just about plain old economics.
No, exactly. What we are talking about is the potential for the end of globalization. And as we've suggested with Harold James, this idea of the end of globalization, what that brings with it is very, very harrowing, very, very ugly from a geopolitical standpoint, obviously. But when you enter a trade war, you are on the cusp of real war with all the consequences that has for human life. We've seen the body count grow in this century following the previous periods of globalization contracting and trade and conflict between nations emerging. So we don't have a good set of options. We really don't have a good set of options. And even the set of options that Richard Duncan suggests, there's no guarantee that it works.
Yeah, David, listening to that, though, both of our concerns would be, you know, how in the world do you get a government that's acted so poorly in the past and padded their pockets in the past to all start coordinating towards something that's productive for the future?
And that's exactly the issue. As I see it, you've got the political elite today who've entrenched themselves as lifetime politicians. Now they have aspirations of not only having political power, but lining their pockets and creating monetary wealth and power for themselves as well. We need to create a system of accountability on Washington, and perhaps it is via social media that we can keep politicians accountable. Last year, we witnessed just how powerful social media was as Twitter and Facebook defined and redefined political groups. And I think there is a measure of accountability which we can see and should see. And perhaps we should, as individual citizens, explore how to hold Washington accountable via social media networks.
But if we can't, then we better protect ourselves individually, our families, and our community.
And certainly that balanced approach that Richard talks about is vitally important, with the insurance component being perhaps the only thing that you truly control.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Richard Duncan. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.